All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Quick heads up, we are calls and questions are really light right now. So if you have a question, a comment, a topic, anything at all you want to talk about, press 1 on your phone. If you do it right now, I guarantee we'll get to you. We might only be doing an hour today. If the calls and questions stay this light, we'll stop at an hour. If they pick up, we'll do another one. So I'll keep you informed, but here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website, the show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. Really, we'll talk about anything at all. If you've got a question, pick up the phone, give me a call. We'll cover it here on the air. I'm going to get to those calls in just a little bit. It's that time of year. There's a lot of stuff going on. Normally, if I say that, you know, we're in the fourth quarter, it's time to start thinking about accounting and taxes, which is true. It's also time to think about getting ready for winter driving. I covered this about a month or so ago and created a checklist, and we made that checklist available as a PDF download. You can find it at the website, letstruck.com. Now, it's mostly a maintenance checklist for your truck, and it's actually something I recommend doing every quarter. And the fourth quarter, probably the most important, getting ready for winter driving. We're already hearing about snow flying. The last couple winters have been pretty rough in some parts of the country. So there's a couple other things to be thinking about, though. Winter time, several things change. One, your equipment is critically important. Get the checklist, download the checklist, go through it, get your equipment ready for winter time. Don't get stuck this year. Not being prepared. I'm not going to go through all the stuff. The checklist is there. You can do that. A couple other things, though. Think about not only your equipment, but no matter how good of shape your equipment is in, think about the possibility of being stuck on a road somewhere that's closed because of an accident or a storm. We've had a lot of that going on, a lot of chain reaction accidents that tie up roads and storms that have tied up roads for days sometimes. So the other thing you should think about having in your truck is warm weather or warm clothing, coveralls, thermals, jackets, boots, gloves, hats, that kind of stuff. So if something happens, you're prepared. And food and water. You know, emergency food, you can get it at camping stores, you can get it online. Great to have in the truck in that situation, water as well. And I know space is limited, but this is the time of year where you will be very, very happy if you are prepared, and you will be very miserable if you're not and you find yourself in that situation. So get those things checked off your list and be prepared this year. Something else I was thinking about, you know, I hear a lot about flu shots. I talked about this the other day. I'm not a big fan. There's a lot of money behind pushing flu shots because there's a lot of money to be made. And I just think you're far better off being healthy. Healthy people don't need flu shots. That's really what it comes down to. Healthy people don't need flu shots. If you have a compromised immune system, you might need a flu shot. But even then, there's no guarantee that a flu shot's going to do you a bit of good. There are hundreds of strains of flu, and most flu shots only protect you from one or two. So the odds aren't even that good that if you get the shot, you're still not going to get the flu. I'm not a big fan. I think you should work on getting your immune system healthier. That's a much better strategy, in my opinion. But something else to think about. We hear about the cold and flu season, and we assume that it must have something to do with the weather, but that doesn't make a whole lot of sense because it happens in warm climates. I mean, we used to get hit just as hard in Florida as they did in Michigan. Well, it can't be the weather. The two are totally different. So what is it then? Why does flu season and cold season tend to peak around January and February? I have another thought, and this isn't original. I've read this in other places, but it's certainly something to think about. Diet and lifestyle are critically important. Think about what starts happening in October. October, we have Halloween, lots of candy, lots of junk food, parties. At school, lots of candy, lots of junk food. Then we go to Thanksgiving, lots of bad eating, junk food, lots of sugar, lots of parties. Then we go from Thanksgiving to Christmas. Now, not only are we eating bad during all those times, there's a lot of stress. Families don't get along. We've heard all the stories. You got shopping, and it's a difficult time of year for a lot of people. Then we go through Christmas and New Year's. And then not long after that, the cold and flu season peaks. I don't think it has much at all to do with the weather. I think it has to do with diet and stress. Something to think about this year. We're going to get to your phone calls, see what you want to talk about. Let's head off to Montana. Al, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Kevin. I wanted to say, I want to add something to the Bulletproof Coffee, something that incorporated when I was young, and this is kind of traditional. I'm Latin. My mom's Mexican. And my mom used to make me in a liquefier, put some milk, a couple of eggs, a banana, and some chocolate mix, kind of like Hershey's, but in Mexico they had this one called Choco Milk, and that one had back in the 60s, it was packed with vitamins, and I would, you know, put in the blender and take it like the nice thick shake, and man, that thing would give you a bunch of energy. So what I started was I started putting an egg in the blender with the Bulletproof Coffee. I got the Christopher egg, like you mentioned, and I put that in, and you don't taste the egg. It's just a little thicker. That's all it does, but you're getting the benefit of the 660 milligrams of omega-3, right?
And a raw egg lots form. And lots of other nutrients in a raw egg. And a raw egg is really the best way to eat it because all the nutrients are left intact, so that's a great idea.
Oh, okay, great. That was another side question I was going to ask you. Was it better eating it raw? Because I've been adding. Now,
it is.
I'm pre-diabetic. I've been pre-diabetic for a long time. I don't think will be. I'm going to go see the doctor probably in next month or so. I've been avoiding him. But I've lost about 30 pounds already. I feel great. I cut the sugar and everything. But is it okay to add a banana since I'm trying to fix the sugar? Is there too much sugar in a banana to put in it? Because that's what my mom used to put in the mix.
You know, I think it is too much. And I think the reason that it's too much, there are some nutrients in bananas, but not really a lot. I don't think it's worth, I don't think it's worth the sugar load. Today's bananas are extremely high in sugar. We can taste them. They're very sweet. I love bananas, but they are very sweet. And if somebody were really healthy and they had a good insulin response and they had blood sugar control and they wanted to have a banana once in a while, probably not a big deal. But I think if you've got some blood sugar issues that you're not really getting much benefit from the banana and there's clearly a downside.
Oh, okay, good. All right. I'm still away. Because, I was bad. I used to have a little bit of coffee with my cream and sugar every morning.
The cream, not so bad, especially if you're using half and half or heavy whipping cream, low in carbs. If you get organic or, you know, grass-fed, it's really good for you. And, you know, if you can just keep cutting back on the sugar. Or now if you're doing, you know, more of a bulletproof coffee with no sugar, that's going to make a big difference.
Oh yeah, yeah, I did. I mean, I quit the gluten, the wheat, everything. I got all the main four books, the Grain Brain, Wheat Belly, and Eat the Yolks. Yeah, you're right. That one is really good. Eat the Yolks. She explains everything, and it's fun to listen to her how she says certain words, right?
I know. I know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. A question on rolling resistance on the Firestone 561 all position. What's the rolling resistance on that versus a Michelin Trader tire, the X Line Trader tire? I had those before.
The 561 is not on the list. I can't find it anywhere. I don't know if that tire's so new. I have a 560 on the list. And I don't know if they're similar or not. The 560 is at 121, which is fairly high. But I can't find a 561 anywhere.
Okay, because I put two. I had the X-Lines on there. They were wore out, and so I put two in my trailer. I got a spread axle. And so with my scan gauge, I didn't see any difference at all. I was really surprised. It's only two tires, though.
Yeah, you know, two tires, there is a difference, but it's pretty difficult to measure. Trailer tires are clearly more important in rolling resistance. That's the most important position. So if you get all your trailer tires down to a low rolling resistance, you will see the difference. Now, again, scan gauge isn't always the best tool for that kind of stuff. We would like to use real fuel mileage. I'll do some more looking for that tire, but it's just possible that it's new enough that it hasn't been tested yet. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is Tom. We're going to roll right along. We're going to head to Virginia this time. Ken, welcome to the program.
Hi there. How are we doing today?
Good. What can I help you
with? On Sunday's show, you had a man that was talking about putting bars leak into his system. Very bad idea. I just went through a $2,000 repair because I bought a 2001 Mac about a month and a half ago. And somebody had put in a bunch of bars leak, and on Mac, which nobody knew, even the service place didn't know, their coolant line comes out, is the lowest part of the system. And when they pulled that line, it was that bars leak was just all jam-packed in there.
Go ahead.
One of the questions I have, is there a way to, because what they did for the repair, and Mac told them to do this. They said that was a common problem. They went around to one of the ports on the intake from the driver's side, which is a higher port, and ran a new line over to the coolant for the new compressor. But now I've got all that bars leak in there. Is there a way to blow that out without doing an in-frame to it?
I have no idea. And this is why when, you know, I talked about this on Sunday, I said I'm just not a fan of these kind of products. I never have been. Whether they work or not to stop the leak isn't the point. The point is what kind of damage they could do to the system. I mean, I talked about it on Sunday. If this is designed so that when it finds a gap, it fills the gap and hardens and seals, well, we can't possibly know where else in the system that could happen. And once it's in there, I don't know how you get it out. So whether it's bars leak or any product that claims to coat things or seal things or fix leaks or even oil additives, where, you know, the oil additive claims that it can cling to a part and protect it better. Well, you know what? That's not the way the engine was designed. The engine was designed to have a film of oil to protect it, and oil works just fine to do that. If we have a product that, and first of all, a lot of times I don't believe that they can cling to the part, but, and if they can't, then they're worthless. If they can, though, what are they doing to these small openings and places inside the engine where tolerances are tight? So, you know, this comes back to my philosophy on additives of just about across the board. The only thing I want to put in my cooling system is good coolant. The only thing I want to put in my crankcase is good oil. So you're a great example of exactly what I was trying to explain on Sunday.
Oh, exactly. And you're looking at a $2,000 repair just out of nowhere that I was not expecting. And now I know that it's in there. I'm kind of OCD. I want it out of there.
I know. And
it's like, how do I get it out and without pulling the engine and doing a acid wash on it, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. If it stays liquid, then we could get it out with a drain and a flush, but I think the idea is that it turns to a solid. I mean, that's how it has to fill
it,
the gap, and stop the leak. So I don't know what kind of a solvent we would have to run through there to get it out.
Well, see, I was thinking, because it looked like it had just packed into, because there's like a tube that was on the end of the fitting. And it just looked like everything was just packed in there. And once you poked it a little bit, it all kind of dissolved out. So I was wondering if you could back pressure it with air and push it back in and then just totally keep flushing and letting the water go through and push all of that gook out through the hoses, you know, and so it came totally pure and clean.
You know, it's worth a shot. There's really no downside to doing that I can think of, other than, you know, if we have
blowing
big clumps of this stuff. Pretty tough to do. The amount of air pressure or anything we're going to run through there should not be enough to blow a gasket anywhere. So, you know, within reason, running a flush through and running some pressure probably is your best bet at trying to get it out of there.
Okay. Now, since Pittsburgh Power doesn't work on Macs, do you have any suggestions for somebody that will?
I don't. You know, and those, I've said many times, those early Macs, I love that engine. But,
oh, I do,
you know,
too. My high is 7.3 so far on fuel mileage, and I haven't done anything to it. And I've been running my heavy loads right now in the mountains of Pennsylvania and Virginia. And my low is 5.83, and that's when I had to get into it one time due to the fact that I had a breakdown and had to make an appointment time. So, but
now,
most of it, I'm sitting right
Power
around 6.6. Yeah, I called Pittsburgh Power, and they said they don't work on Macs at all.
Okay.
So
it's such a small percentage of the over-the-road engines that typically – you know, it's a more vocational truck. It tends to stay fairly local, construction, refuse, those kind of things. So your best bet is probably to try to find a good Mac shop someplace locally.
Right. Yeah. That's what I've ended up doing. I've changed my mechanic already once now. So, because the first one, I had it into him three different times. And that, when I took it out, I had three different road calls that I had to end up having service on the road.
Boy.
It's like, all three things, it was things that I told him to check to ask about before I started it up.
Yeah.
It's
certainly one of the more difficult things. I remember when I first moved to Florida, I moved down to Jacksonville, and I spent a year and went through every shop I could find and was never happy with the service in Jacksonville. And I kind of then when I moved to Orlando, started over again, and it took me about another year there till I found a shop that I actually liked. So it's not easy, but it's worth it. You've got to keep trying until you find somebody you can work with. Let's see. We're going to head off to Oregon. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What can I help you?
Yeah, I've just got a question about an automatic transmission, Eaton 13-speed smart shift.
Okay.
Do you know anything about them?
I do, and let's clarify one thing, and this is going to sound like I'm being real nitpicky, but we should refer to these transmissions as auto shifts, not automatics, or
okay.
automated manual transmissions. The reason
All
being
right.
is, and I think it's going to become a little more important because it looks like we're finally going to start seeing some true automatic transmissions. Mesilla Valley, I think, just ordered a bunch of trucks with a true automatic. Now, that's an Allison. And there's a big difference in a true automatic and an auto shift. I'm not a big fan of true automatics. I'm surprised that Mesilla Valley ordered them. Maybe they know something I don't know about this new generation. But most true automatic transmissions are not very efficient. In fact, I've got one in the coach I just bought, and it's driving me nuts because my fuel mileage is so bad. But what you have, or the 13-speed Eaton, is virtually identical to the same 13-speed Eaton we've had for the last 30 years. The only it's really a manual transmission that gets shifted by the computer.
Right. Okay.
So
that's good to know.
Yeah, and I do have quite a bit of experience. I've owned several of these, and I've kind of got mixed feelings. I love them when they work properly because it gives us the best of both worlds. I put my auto shifts into manual mode a lot and shift it myself. But then I always have the ability, kind of like cruise control, I can use it when it makes sense, when I don't want the auto shift. So for me, it's really the best of both worlds. The problem I've had is when they stop working properly, and it's hard to find a shop that knows how to troubleshoot them. So,
yeah.
You know, I've had some that have gone a million miles, no problems whatsoever. I had another one that cost me over $10,000, and I was still never sure if we got it fixed right.
All right, so I suppose in most of the Freightliner dealers probably wouldn't have much experience with them, would they?
Well, that's really your only option. See, this is another
yeah.
thing. When we talk about engine problems, we have specific engine shops. You can go to Detroit, you can go to CAT, you can go to Cummins, and that's what I recommend. The problem with transmissions, we don't have any dedicated transmission shops. So it really is the mechanics at places like Freightliner and, you know, Kenworth dealers where
yeah.
they're trained on this transmission. I just don't know, you know, so far the people that I've dealt with, I've known more about the transmission than they have half the time.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. Thanks a lot for the info.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. The music's playing. That means I've got to get to a break, but don't go away. We'll be right back with more stuff from Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. We're off to Minnesota this time. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. It's nice to talk to you again. Also, fair
What's on your mind
yesterday,
today?
My friend.
Yeah,
I was
there
having an
go.
Argument with a friend of mine about construction in single lane versus two lane due to the merge point.
Okay.
Is there like a code of the road to say, or is there a law? Are states differ as far as having one lane versus two lanes to the merge point? And I'm the type of guy, I get in, I merge before, way before the lane ends, just to be courteous, to keep the traffic flowing. What is your take on that situation?
You know, this is an interesting topic, and there is a lot of controversy about this, and there are different rules in different states, but the trend in most states, and it comes from a couple different studies that have come out. There's even a book called Traffic.
Okay.
Kind of an interesting book. You can pick it up. It's on audio. It's almost more of a psychology book than it is truly a book about traffic, but it talks about some interesting things, like they've actually proven that speed bumps in neighborhoods cause people to drive faster, not slower. You know, things you just wouldn't expect. Yeah, it's crazy stuff. But there was a lot of studies done, I know, about this topic, the merge point. And most states now are moving to a mandatory merge point that's measured backwards from where the two lanes actually come together. So they're showing that what should happen is that vehicles should start moving together and merging while they're still at speed, which means you've got to start doing it quite a ways before the two lanes actually come together. And if that doesn't happen, by the time you get to the merge point, that's where it creates the bottleneck. So there are states now that are saying, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. They're bringing two lanes of traffic flowing to one lane. When you bring in both lanes at full speed, of course you're going to have backups. I don't get their reasoning behind having two lanes to the merge point.
Well, that's what they're trying to do now. They're trying to say, okay, the two lanes are going to come together in a mile, but you have to start merging now. That makes the most sense.
The person I'm in a confrontation with or argument with is insisting that we both lanes go to the merge point and then they merge, not ahead of time, not early, at the merge point. And to me, it's going to create more mass confusion and more backups doing it that way.
It does, because you virtually have to come to a stop. It's impossible not to. If you go from two lanes to one and you have to do it right there, there's no more physical space left to make the merge smooth. And that's why, if that happens, the traffic comes to a stop. Now, some people will say, well, it's safer to merge that way anyway. No, it's not, because you don't want traffic stopped on an interstate. This is why we always see an accident in the construction, right, you know, because somebody came to a stop, somebody else isn't paying attention. You want the traffic to keep moving as close to the posted speed as possible. Now, obviously, if the speed limit is 65 and the speed limit in the construction is 35, we do want traffic to slow down to 35, but we don't want it to slow down to zero. That's what's going to cause the problem. So there are states now that are saying, okay, the two lanes physically come down to one in a mile, but this is the mandatory merge point. And that actually gives some room for error, and it gives us some room to work this all out. So, you know, the whole idea, and this has always kind of made me crazy, the whole idea of the truck that gets over there and tries to hold traffic back is creating an early artificial merge point that creates more problems. Because now you've done the same thing the physical merge point does. You've all of a sudden, with no warning, here's a driver, he's doing what he should be doing. He's watching the signs. He sees that there's construction in 1 mile, and he's going to think about starting to merge, if he's a good driver. And all of a sudden, there's no more lane because there's a truck in that lane blocking traffic. That creates a problem. So
Minnesota has
put
out a video, and it's on the post is shared to my Facebook page of a video encouraging merging at the merge point, two lanes to the merge point. And I didn't get their reasoning behind it.
That's what I mean. There's a lot of controversy about this, but most of the research has shown the earlier you can get those two lanes to merge, the better off everybody's going to be, and you're seeing states start to move in that direction.
I live in Minnesota, so we're a little bit backwards here, if anybody's been fortunate enough to come and deal with our DOT department.
Yeah, it's not unusual.
What was the name of that book again, Kevin, that you mentioned?
Traffic.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time, sir.
You're welcome. It's actually kind of a strange book, but there's some interesting stuff in there, things about that you just wouldn't expect, whether or not the ramp metering works or not. I won't give away all the fun stuff in the book, but it's not one of my favorite books, but there was some interesting stuff in there. It's worth a listen. Let's head off to Texas. Cameron, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin.
Hey there.
Couple things I want to talk to you about. First of all, the Turbo 3000, you used to be a big, you'd always tell people that they should get one and put it on their truck, and I haven't heard that for a long time. Is the technology changed?
Yeah, somewhat engine technology changed. So, I've said many times that we had pretty clear criteria for products we would recommend, especially fuel mileage products. Our criteria was we needed to see about a 70% success ratio. We know we're never going to get 100, not on fuel mileage, just never going to happen. So over the years, I kind of figured out that if we took 10 trucks and you did the modification to 10 trucks and you got a positive result in 7 or more, that was a good sign. Why you don't get it in 10, who knows? There's too many variables. You put a modification on a truck, but something else goes wrong. You put a modification on the truck and then the operation changes a little bit. So you're always going to have trucks that don't respond. But if we got 7 out of 10, we were good. The Turbo 3000 was actually one of the first products I tested way, way before I ever had a radio show. When I was back doing my own fuel mileage testing, and I got virtually positive results on every truck I put it on. I had one that I didn't get a result on. It was actually a Mercedes engine, and it turns out, this sounds kind of stupid, but I had it on the wrong fuel line. The Mercedes, back then, there were two different configurations, one with the fuel line going in one side and the return line coming out of the other, and on another engine that looked identical, it was actually backwards, and because of the way they had the covers, you couldn't tell. So when I finally got it on the right fuel line, I got results even on that engine. Almost all of my testing was on Series 60s. What started to happen was, and for years we maintained about that 70 to 80% positive result number. What kept happening, though, was we kept getting more and more results of people saying they weren't seeing the benefit. And it was people I trusted, and the more we dug into it, the numbers started to drop. It didn't seem to work on the ISX at all, because I don't think we could get it close enough to the fuel rail system. There was always a filter in between. And it became kind of a distraction because it was a very controversial product. And it just wasn't worth all the arguing about whether it really worked or not. And on the new engines with the high-pressure rail systems, it just wasn't working. So we made the decision that, at one point we got good results. At another point, the results started to be mixed, and then we were arguing about it all the time, and finally I said, it's just not worth it. The FAS does the same thing and actually does it a little better. So it was a lot of things coming together. The fact that we were seeing, a lot more mixed results, the fact we were always arguing about it, and then the fact that the FAS did the same thing and did it more consistently was why we moved away from that product.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense.
I know you've got some other questions. Hold that thought. I've got to get to a break. and I'm going to come back to you right after this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. Quick heads up here. Let me take a look. We're heading into the fourth segment. I'm trying to see if we're going to do a second hour or not. Questions are a little light. I think we're going to wrap it up in 1 hour today. So this will be the last segment. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get back to the phone calls. I was talking with Cameron in Texas. Cameron, go ahead.
Yeah, well, the other question I had was I took my truck in for the annual inspection in my shop at the company that I'm leased on with, and they failed me over a transmission leak. And, I was just waiting for, to do a clutch to get the leak done. I didn't want to leave it, but, I also didn't want to fix a leak until, and it wasn't a big leak. It was just a little drip, but he told me at the shop that, DOT will fail you for having a leak like that. Have you ever heard of that?
There are some criteria for leaks, but, if you look at the statistics about out of service, and I look at it every year when we have the big blitz, and I look at it every year when the report comes out about what kind of things, are out of service criteria and how many of each. Brakes are obviously the big one every year. Leaks are way, way, way down the list. It is pretty rare to have a vehicle put out of service for a leak. It has to be a pretty severe leak.
Well, it wasn't that severe, but I got to say.
Yeah, and one of the things you could do if you've got a dispute with somebody, in a company shop or that kind of thing, you could always just pull over at a now you run the risk of you're going to have to get it fixed out on the road if it truly is out of service, but you can always pull in and request an inspection and ask them to look at that item and, have an enforcement officer tell you whether or not it would truly put the truck out of service.
Good luck getting any driver that's been out here any length of time to pull in and volunteer for inspection. Kevin, in a perfect world, but
no,
ain't never going to happen this yet.
Well, here's the thing, though, and I have done it, and it is a whole different ballgame. Part of the reason I started doing this, and I haven't done it a lot, but when I was on Florida's road team, one of the things we would do in order to try to understand enforcement better and create a better relationship, as part of the road team, we would go out and spend the day at the scale, or I've gone out and done ride-alongs with enforcement. And, you get to know them. It's not that adversarial where you pull in and you're trying to hide something and they're trying to find something. When you pull in and you say, look, here, I really want to know. I can't get a straight answer. Could you help me with this? You get a totally different response. Unless the guy is a total asshole, and there are some, so you do run that risk, he's not going to crawl all over your truck looking to find something. They're much more likely to be, with a totally different attitude at that point. But I understand what you're saying. No sense in inviting trouble if you don't have to.
Yeah. And the last thing I just wanted to tell you is I was on the ketogenic diet for 3 weeks before I went home on 13 pounds. So I was real happy with that.
Excellent.
And have you ever heard of the fat bombs?
Yes.
On YouTube, you can go on YouTube and get the recipe. And those are great, a little snack.
Yeah, there's all kinds of fat bombs. You know, people on a ketogenic diet are always looking for ways to get more fat into their diet. And there's some great ideas. Bulletproof coffee kind of goes along with that whole theme. Let's see. Let's head off to Virginia. Joe, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Kevin?
Doing good. What can I help you with?
I've got something in my fuel, and I don't know what it is. I had just sent off a sample, but didn't get results back yet, but I figured I'd run it past you. I first found it my last service. I asked the guys, you know, to let me watch as the fuel filter was being drained, and we ran it across a piece of white cloth, and I could see little black specks. So we cleaned out the bowl and the bottom. It didn't look right. It looked discolored in the bottom of the bowl on a DAFCO.
Okay.
So I ran it for a while, and then a couple days ago I decided, let me check it, because I felt like I was losing power. So I took a plastic jug, a clear plastic jug, and I let some fuel out of the bottom of the DAFCO, and I got about a tablespoon of water, and then I see, again, it looks discolored to me, but I see these black spots, and they're different shapes, and they're small, so I was able to get some out and touch them. And when you touch it, it just smears. It's black.
Ah, okay.
It smears, and it didn't feel like, you know, some people say they get mildew, which I think tends to be more of a slicker substance, almost like a, you know, like soap would be. At least that's been my experience, but I don't know what it is. And then I started
go ahead.
Back in the spring, the engine was running rough, and I took it into Cummins. Cummins told me back then, you know, your filter was clogged, and I had some buildup in the IFSM pump, which is really the pump that monitors the fuel going into it. This is on an ISX. That needed to be rebuilt.
I was going to ask if it's an ISX, and there's three substances we can get in the fuel that show up black. One is algae, and it will tend to be kind of slimy and slippery feeling. The other one, and it's very common on the ISX, is what's called asphaltene. And it comes from a combination of a lower quality fuel and high temperatures. The ISX is notorious for getting the fuel very hot and then returning it back to the tank. The third is soot. We can get soot in the fuel. It's pretty rare. My guess is you've got asphaltene. That's what it sounds like, because asphaltene does settle to the bottom of the system and the bottom of the filters, and it's more common in the ISX than most other engines. So much so that the only company I know that makes a product to fix it is Cummins. I mean, they have a product you dump in the tanks to get rid of asphaltene, and that's the name of it. It's called asphaltene. The good news is that it's much easier to get rid of than algae. Algae, because it's a living organism, if you don't wipe it out completely the first time, it can come back. Asphaltene, usually, you dump some of the treatment in the tanks, and this will go away.
But wouldn't it be gritty or no?
No, it's really not. It does tend to collect in little globules like you're talking about. Soot would be gritty. If we get soot in the fuel, it will feel gritty. Or you won't be able to feel it at all because it's so fine. Asphaltene can actually tend to feel sticky sometimes. But based on all the factors, I think that's really what you're seeing here. I'm going to get to another call. I'm going to head off to Washington. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What can I help you with?
Well, I just spent the weekend getting started on fuel and profit gauges. And,
oh, excellent.
I got all my fuel entered for the year on fuel gauges. Love it. Fantastic.
Good.
Program. And so yesterday I was working on the profit gauges, and I was having a little trouble. I've been working the last 23 years as a corporation, and
okay.
So it was a little tricky trying to get stuff entered as a corporation. And
right.
If you take a look at my profit report, I've only got up through April, January through April.
Okay.
And
I've got it here in front of me, and I'm looking at it. Everything looks good. There are a couple things. One, for some reason, we're seeing a 36-cent negative under accounting.
Well, what I did was, in order to get started right, I had on January 1, I had $5,000 in the checking account. And without getting that into the program somehow, I was getting just horrible numbers at the end of April. Because I had all these expenses that had been paid for with that money from December.
Okay. Yeah,
if you understand
we need
what I'm saying.
To fix that. And, yeah, I do. This is one of those things that would be much better dealt with not on the air. I mean, most of what you've got here looks good. We just need to do a little tweaking. What I would really recommend is that we get you set up with an appointment with Brittany. And Brittany will go through and get this all fixed. And then you and I could go through numbers on the air as far as are they good, where could we improve. But when it comes down to the individual trying to fix the entries, it just gets a little tedious on the air. But we can certainly get you fixed up. So give us a call. We'll set you up with Brittany. I'm all out of time. We'll see you next show. Be safe, be profitable, do the hard work, and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, we're going to wrap it up today. I know there are a couple questions left, but not really enough to get us through a second hour. So we will see you back here tomorrow. If you're still on hold with a question, call in first thing tomorrow, and I promise I'll get to you. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you then.